Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, an interview on the Dissection Choice Initiative at the University of Illinois, a talk by Robert McChesney on media and empire, and a collage of community voices supporting the recent anti-war resolution in Urbana. But first, these headlines.
A community coalition called Citizens for a Responsible Community was formed to publicly express support for University of Illinois Chancellor Nancy Cantor and to promote a unified community where civility and respect allow for different points of view to be shared and considered. Citizens for a Responsible Community has also placed a billboard at Prospect and Bradley that reads, quote, "Support our Chancellor, support our university," unquote. The coalition was formed in response to a series of billboards which openly criticized Chancellor Cantor and which expressed support for the university mascot, Chief Illiniwek.
An important bill affecting bicycling conditions through Illinois has passed the Senate House, the State House. Senate Bill 275 would correct the negative impact of the 1998 Illinois Supreme Court Bob versus Wayne decision, which has been a disaster for on-road cycling in the state. Until the bill gets passed, towns that want to improve on-road bike safety through signage or bike lanes are penalized with liability. Towns that do nothing get immunity. Bicyclists do not have any liability protection as motorcyclists and motorists do and bicyclists in other states do. Long-distance bikeways like the Grand Illinois Trail and Mississippi River Trail and many other local plans are being stalled. Illinois is the only state with this bizarre and powerful disincentive for improving bike safety. House Bill 1248 passed in House Committee 1341 on Thursday. Senate Bill 275 will be heard in Senate Committee on Wednesday. Senator Rick Winkle's office would be delighted to hear comments from concerned citizens. The number of his office is 355-4994.
The following story was reported on the Chicago IMC website. In a disturbing indication that the Bush administration is perfectly willing to use its anti-terrorism powers for political purposes, Irish activist and former Member of Parliament Bernadette Devlin McAlisky was detained by immigration officials in Chicago February 21st and denied entry into the United States, allegedly on national security grounds. According to her daughter, Deidre, two INS officials threatened to arrest, jail, and even shoot the legendary civil rights campaigner when she arrived at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. McAlisky, 56, was then photographed, fingerprinted, and returned to Ireland against her will on the grounds that the State Department had declared that she was, quote, poses a serious threat to the security of the United States, end quote. According to her daughter, Deidre, the McAliskys cleared U.S. immigration in Ireland prior to boarding and received routine permission to travel, but upon their arrival they were stopped at baggage claim. Detained by two INS officers, they were told that the order to bar Bernadette McAlisky came from U.S. officials in Dublin. Does the U.S. government consider Bernadette Devlin McAlisky a security risk? Quote, "I can't imagine what threat they could think she poses to U.S. security," says Deidre, "unless the threat is knowing too much and saying it too well."
The Associated Press reports that a member of the basketball team at Manhattanville College in New York has been turning her back on the American flag during the national anthem played at the beginning of each game. Tony Smith, a senior sociology major, turns away from the flag as a statement against growing inequalities in America and as a protest against the plans of the Bush administration to start a war in Iraq. Smith has courageously faced taunts and harassment from the crowd, including a game in which people chanted, quote, "leave our country," unquote, and another game in which a man ran out onto the court and tried to shove an American flag in her face. Last Thursday, she released a statement describing the reasons for her silent protest. quote, "For some time now, the inequalities that are embedded into the American system have bothered me, as they are becoming progressively worse, and it is clear that the government's priorities are not on bettering the quality of life for all of its people, but rather on expanding its own power. I cannot, in good conscience, salute the flag," unquote.
The Associated Press reports that Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Vermont, will purge all of patrons' records of book purchases upon request. This is in response to the provision of the Patriot Act, which makes it much easier for federal agents to obtain a subpoena for library and bookstore records of American citizens. These special subpoenas are not susceptible to the normal process of challenge and review, and bookstores, which are made to hand over their customers' records, are not allowed to tell anyone such a request has been made. The owners of Bear Pond Books have circumvented the whole process, however, by not keeping purchase records on patrons who request it. Michael Katzenberg, one of the store's owners, had this to say. "When the CIA comes in and asks what you've read because they're suspicious of you, we can tell them that we don't have it. That's just a basic right to be able to read what you want without fear that somebody is looking over your shoulder to see what you're reading."
That wraps up the headlines for today's show. Thanks to Kevin Heinrich for coordinating them and Kevin Sevilla and Avram for reading them here in the studio. Also to Ondin Gross and Bruce Kruger for contributing stories. Undergraduate students at the U of I may soon have a choice as to whether they must kill animals in order to learn how to save them. Ondin Gross produced the following interview on the Dissection Choice Initiative at the university.
Following is an interview conducted by Danielle Marino on the ethical objection to dissection of animals.
I'm Danielle Marino with the latest on the campaign for student choice for dissection alternatives at the University of Illinois. We're here with Dr. Eric Denayer of the ASPCA's Animal Poison Control Center and former vet student at the University of Pennsylvania to discuss the policy or the potential policy at the University of Illinois. Dr. Denayer, can you tell us a little bit about your story and why you're here with us today?
Thank you, Danielle. Yes, when I was a student at the University of Pennsylvania, as most veterinary schools in those days did, I was required to harm animals during the course of my training. In 1 year, we had what was called a pharmacology lab in which we were required to carry out several experiments in which animals were either injured or killed as part of the experiment. And then the following year, during my third year, we had a required surgery course in which dogs purchased for the purpose of surgical training would have surgeries performed on them 1 week and allowed to wake up. And then the following week, they would have a surgery performed and then they would be killed at the end of the exercise. So in both cases, a classmate of mine and I went to the professors and said that we had ethical objection to this. We had gone into veterinary medicine to help animals, not to kill them, and we requested that alternatives that would allow us to complete the training in the same way as our classmates, but without killing the animals, would be allowed. Well, in the first case in the pharmacology lab, they did not give us an alternative, but they simply ignored the fact that we did not attend the lectures, the labs. And in the second part, in the surgery training, they went ahead and failed us for failure to attend after they refused to give us an alternative. Because of that failure, we were forced to sue the school, and in a out-of-court settlement, we were allowed to complete the training using animals who were going to be euthanized for existing medical conditions and who, you know, needed to be put to sleep because of their suffering. We were able to complete the surgical course and go on and graduate.
Where did the animals you use come from, and how did you feel prepared to work on other live animals with learning in such a different way?
Well, it wasn't actually that different. The dogs who we did surgery on were dogs who had been somebody's companion, and they agreed to let us do the surgeries. The dogs were anesthetized deeply beforehand, so it was as though they were being put to sleep, euthanized, and so it was, to them, there was no pain and suffering. Many vet schools today, in fact, most vet schools today now offer alternatives to their students, and in fact, three veterinary schools, including University of Pennsylvania, now have absolutely no training that involves required training that involves killing or harming live animals. And in that case, the animals are often donated from, you know, the animals who were put to sleep and their owners donate their bodies, knowing that they'll be used for training purposes and knowing that that will reduce the need for harming live animals. And in many cases, veterinary schools have worked out agreements with the local humane societies for their students, after they become proficient in surgery, to spay and neuter the animals from the humane society. So the students gain practice, the animals being spayed or neutered are more likely to be adopted. So it's a win-win situation for both the students, who don't have to harm animals, and the dog or cat, who then has a better chance of finding a permanent home.
One of the arguments I've heard people against such a policy make is that students are squeamish, that they need to be able to handle such procedures. If they can't watch the anatomy, or they can't look at the anatomy of an animal cut open, how are they going to become doctors? I mean, I understand your situation. You're fine with working on ethically sourced animals, but what about these students who are just squeamish?
Well, I think in many cases when someone's accused of being squeamish, it's an excuse. I was accused of being squeamish, and that was why I did not want to do surgery in my veterinary school. While that's certainly the farthest thing from the truth, I had worked in many areas of veterinary medicine, including emergency medicine, before I got into veterinary school. And I do surgery all the time. I'm not squeamish. And it's not squeamishness. It's an ethical sense of not doing harm.
So this might have more in common with conscientious objection to military service, or objection to such as a Muslim student being forced to eat pork in a food science course. It's that type of objection?
Oh, I think that's a very apt comparison. It would be asking someone like a Muslim student or an Orthodox Jewish student or a Hindu vegetarian to do something that violates their religion in, as you say, a food science class, preparing and eating a food which that particular religion believes is off limits. It's the same. It wouldn't be any different to ask a vegetarian student to do that. I believe, from a legal standpoint, you're violating that person's personal beliefs, and they have the right to say, I won't do that, and they should not be penalized that, because that is their beliefs, and the school or anybody at the school has no right to make them do something that violates their personal beliefs and code of ethics.
Now, your case at the University of Pennsylvania in being a conscientious objector to the veterinary school there went to court. Have other students gone to court, and have they been successful?
Several have gone to court. Most of the cases end up being settled out of court for the simple reason that for the school, it's not a very good publicity issue. When I was in veterinary school and I graduated in 1988, there was not a single veterinary school in this country out of the 27 or so that existed that offered alternatives. Today, most offer alternatives, and as I say, about three or four of them don't even require students to harm living animals during the course of their training. In fact, there's a new school being founded in California that's going to open this fall for students, where one of their guiding principles is to do no harms to animals.
Can you explain a little bit about what's going on currently at the University of Illinois and this undergraduate policy?
Well, the Faculty Student Senate is currently holding some hearings, at least a committee is, hearing from both sides as to how they feel about it, the side that favors the proposal and the side that I wouldn't say necessarily opposes it, but has reservations. And my understanding is there will be some kind of recommendation made from the committee in early March, and sometime in mid-March, I believe around March 17th, the Faculty Senate is going to vote on it. So within the next month or so, we should know whether the University of Illinois Faculty Senate will grant what I believe already is in place. If you read the university's code for students, it states that they already have a policy where they will not discriminate against someone based on their religious beliefs, and that if there is a conflict, there should be a mediation to work out an agreeable solution for both sides. I think this pretty much already falls under that, but I think it needs to be spelled out specifically, because this is a slightly different issue, and I think it wouldn't hurt, obviously, for them to affirm this as being a university policy. But as I say, I think there's already ample evidence that the university already has a policy that covers this.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Denayer, for joining us today. I wish you and all the students working on bringing student choice for dissection alternatives great luck. And I urge our listeners to head to your website, www.dissectionchoice.org, to learn more about this campaign.
Well, thank you, Danielle, for bringing this issue out to the public, and hopefully they'll support it.
For IMC Radio, this is Ondine Gross.
The spider dropping down from twig unfolds a plan of her devising, a thin premeditated rig to use in rising. And all that journey down from space in cool descent and loyal-hearted, she spins a ladder to the place from where she started.
Jim Buell brings us a recording of Institute of Communication Research Professor Robert McChesney speaking at a campus forum organized by the Teachers for Peace and Justice last week. His talk was entitled News, Media, and Empire, A Fundamental Problem for Democracy. The following is an excerpt.
Get a sense of the press coverage of the build-up for this war in Iraq and just how incredibly bogus it is. Imagine if another country, say a country that our government doesn't get along with, like Cuba, announced that it was going to invade Turkey. And it went through a litany of different reasons to justify its invasion, sort of going from one to another every few days. And when it gets called on, it shifts yet to another one. Imagine that. Imagine if it said, as this is absolutely true, that Turkey has violated numerous UN resolutions. That is the justification why we, Cuba, have taken it upon ourselves, we're going to invade that country and get rid of that government. Imagine if it said, well, Turkey violates human rights, which it does. So we, Cuba, will take it upon ourselves to go in and take out that Turkish government and replace it with a more equitable government. If it said that Turkey has, in fact, been opposed to the democratic aspirations of peoples in that region, and Cuba said, because that we will go in and take care of that and eliminate that problem. Or if it said that Turkey has sometimes been linked with terrorist activity, and said, we, Cuba, we will gladly go in and take care of that problem, because we stand on principle. Imagine how Bill O'Reilly would respond to that. Or George W. Bush, or Colin Powell. I mean, their heads would explode. How could these people have a principle, but patently bogus, lame excuses for one country to invade another? Yet, all those reasons are given for the U.S. Planned invasion of Iraq, and all are incredibly bogus and unprincipled. None stands up to scrutiny. None stands up to close scrutiny. It's a viable principle. Principle means it holds to everything, not just to the one time you want to use it. All of them collapse. Yet if one were to consume our news media, as I fear many of you must, one would not know that for the most part. It would be hard to find. You could locate it, but it would certainly not be a major theme in the news media coverage. Instead, these charges would be taken at face value as very serious and legitimate charges, true until proven false, and not proven false with the aid of the news media. Instead, what's obvious to us if you look at it, and what's clear around the world, is that this war is exactly what we would call the war if Cuba said it was going to invade Turkey. A mad dash or any excuse to have a preemptive strike against another government. And that could only be perceived, I think, by the world, as Stephen Hartnett put it in his introduction, as something that's absolutely disastrous for the world today and indefensible. But why is the press coverage so bad? Well, and that's what I'm going to talk about really for the next 10 or 15 minutes. What are the reasons that explain why credible, honest, hardworking, sincere journalists produce a journalism which does such a poor job of illuminating what are patently absurd claims, indefensible claims, drawing them out, informing people so they can participate in the decision-making of this government and have some effect on where this war is going to go or whether it will be a war at all. And here I would say there are several factors that explain the nature of the coverage. I'm going to quickly run through a few of them. The first one, and the starting point, is to understand the way professional journalism works in the United States. Professional journalism is only about 100 years old. It's a relatively recent phenomenon. It replaced a partisan journalism. And under partisan journalism, these guys couldn't get away with this stuff, because there'd be opposition parties calling them on it every turn. But we don't have partisan journalism in the classical sense anymore. We only have the so-called professional journalism. And one of the core characteristics of professional journalism as it emerged about 100 years ago was the reliance on what are called official sources as the basis for legitimate news stories. When people in power say something, you report it. We report, you decide. Basically, people in power become then the people who determine how stories get covered. The great political debates that occur in journalism come when people in power debate each other, when official sources are in conflict, and journalism reports that conflict. That's the tradition we have. What it means, though, is that when people in power are in agreement on an issue, our journalism has a very difficult time exposing it if it's wrong or if it's flawed. Because if a journalist steps outside and challenges the elite consensus of official sources, they're accused of being unprofessional. They're weighing of their own crazy opinions. Hey, no one in power is saying that. Where do you get off saying that, pal? Go back. You report. We decide. You don't weigh in with your own opinion. So it's a very strong small c conservative bias built into professional journalism. It's at its worst in matters of foreign policy. In domestic affairs, there's more mediating factors on official sources to represent other interests other than political and economic elites. Foreign policy in the United States is traditionally a playground of our economic and political elites. It has been for a very long time. It certainly is today. And here the range of news coverage tends to very strictly adhere to elite opinion. The range of debate among those who run the Foreign Relations Committee in the House and Senate, the State Department, the Pentagon, the White House, a very narrow range of people. And it's not really intended to be open to the general public. And usually, then, the range of debate you find is going to mirror the range of debate among elites. And this is the core problem we face. Now, interestingly, as an aside, and we might be able to get into this in the question and answer period, the elite in this country is not uniform in its desire for this war. Which is sort of one reason why the news coverage is that much more interesting, because it's so bad. The elite in this country, there are significant branches of the political, economic, and military elite that think this war is idiotic and understands all the problems you outlined, that it would be disastrous for elite interests. I'm not democratic necessarily, but even for corporate interests or military interests. Occasionally we see leaks now of stories coming out of the Pentagon, the CIA, of people that are like freaking out, because they understand what a disaster this war is going to be. So one of the things interesting is there actually is a lot of elite dissent to this war. What's sort of striking is how little of it manifests itself so far in our news coverage, although I think we're seeing a little bit of it percolate up, but not a great deal. The problem with coverage of foreign policy and U.S. military affairs abroad intensifies in the 20th century also as the United States becomes the leading empire in the world. So we become the new Rome. As we become the country with bases all, especially following 1945, bases all across the planet. And I don't know the exact number of countries we have military bases in now, but it's 70. I knew it was something in that range. I mean, so we are the modern Rome. We rule the world. And our elite in this country is in total agreement on one thing. That's our God-given right to do. I mean, you aren't going to see any debate, gee, should we have 70 bases or not? That's just not on the horizon. So you aren't going to see journalism ever question the U.S. role in the world. It's simply taken as a given. Another thing you won't see our elite in this country, both Republican or Democrat, for the most part challenged, with only a handful of exceptions, or in the business community or in the foreign policy establishment challenge, is that the United States alone, has a 007 right to invade any country it wants at any time for any reason. No other country has this 007 right to invade any country it wants at any time for any reason. The United States does, because we are an empire. We need to have that right. You can't handcuff an empire. How do we whip the world in shape if we can't go and invade countries when we want to? And we cook up whatever reason we want. You know, if the UN backs us, it's because the UN says we have to do it. If they don't back us, well, screw that. It's for another reason. We come up with whatever reason we want because we have a 007 right to invade any country we want at any time, and it's not challenged. And our journalism never challenges that. Journalists never challenge that because no one in power ever questions it. They all internalize that as a necessary value. The U.S. has to have that right. And as you look at the American record of journalism with our involvement in major wars, it's quite striking. And it's worth keeping in mind right now because it applies directly to what we're going through today. Start with, and we've had, I don't know, you seem to be the expert, Sarah, we've had about 50 or 60 foreign wars in the last century, if you include the quickie carpet bombings, I don't know. But we've had 7 or 8 major wars. World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Central American War, Gulf War. Take those wars, for example. In every one of those cases, without exception, the government in power in the White House wanted to go to war desperately. The administration in power. Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Lyndon Baines Johnson, before that Kennedy, Reagan, Bush Sr., all wanted to go to war. But they didn't think they had necessarily the support of the American people. In every one of those cases, they lied to get the American people to support a war. Every single one. Pentagon Papers is the most chilling example of the extent to which our government lied to generate popular support. Because they knew if they told the truth, the American people wouldn't support the war. They wouldn't have supported any of those wars. Now, we might have supported World War II, but the great line about FDR is he didn't lead us into war, he lied us into war. So he didn't trust us to make that decision if we had facts. He thought he had to sort of shape it for us. That's the track record. And in each of those cases, regrettably, the degree of press coverage ranges from mediocre to terrible in its sort of unwillingness to challenge the campaign of lies put forth by the government in power and the weak opposition in general of the party out of power or other people to challenge it up to the point you go into the war. Up to the point you go into the war. Armed with that knowledge, one would expect, and this is not, what I'm saying is not a radical statement. Everyone who studies American history understands what I said is just taken. It's empirically verifiable. Armed with that, you would think when the next time the president comes along waving the flag, say, hey, we got to go to this war, the first thing you do is say, okay, slow down, Ace. We've been down this road before. This time we want some real evidence. This time back up these claims, put the flag down, and let's get it out on the table. You know, we don't want to drop another 100,000 bodies and find out you were BSing us. You would think that's what journalism would do, wouldn't you? I mean, that would be a pretty rational response. We would expect that of Cuban journalists. We would expect that of journalists in other countries. But it doesn't do that. It doesn't do that at all. It's locked within the trajectory of letting elite debate, elite consensus, elite viewpoints guide what is legitimate to cover and what's not legitimate to cover.
Hooray, I awake from yesterday. Alive, but the war is here to stay. So my love, Catherine, and me desire to take a last walk through the noise to the sea. Not to die, but to be reborn. Away from a land so battered and torn.
And that wraps up this week's edition of IMC Radio News. Contributors to this program include Daniel Marino, Ondine Gross, Janet Lowry, Jim Buell, Pete Seeger, and Jimi Hendrix. Remember that this is your radio show. Anybody can help create the news, no experience necessary. If you are interested, you can stop by the IMC at 218 West Main Street in downtown Urbana at 6:30 p.m. for the weekly meeting of the Radio News Group on Thursdays. You can also email radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820 extension 1. Online archives of this show are posted to the IMC's Open News Wire at www.ucimc.org. Taking us out this week is a sound collage produced by Janet Lowry, recording the voices of the recent resolution opposing the pending war in Iraq, which was introduced by Urbana Councilwoman Danielle Chenoweth and passed by the Urbana City Council as a whole, making Urbana one of 110 cities nationwide to take a stand against the war, and that number grows daily. Her segment includes voices from our part of that effort. Thanks for listening, and take care.
I would like to move resolution number 2003-01-002R, and that refers to a resolution opposing war against Iraq. We have 562 people who have gone on record in support of this resolution, and 26 people who have gone on record opposing the resolution.
I am a retired Air Force Technical Sergeant. I support the resolution in opposition to invasion or unprovoked war against the citizens of Iraq.
I think think what's before you tonight is the most important issue that you will probably have to vote on during your term.
There is a growing frustration in the country. And so that the fact that we can now turn to you, I think we're all very, very grateful for this. So thank you.
Ms. Shinawith?
Yes.
Mr. Hayes?
Yes.
Ms. Hoof?
Yes.
Mr. Otto?
No.
Ms. Pat?
Yes.
Mr. Whalen?
No.
Ms. Wyman?
Yes.
There being no other business to come before this August body this evening.